Well, actually, at the moment, I'm a Scotsman with his offering still in his pocket, because nobody came to take it, and that's a foolish thing with a Scotsman. And he's willing to give away money. Somebody's left this cheap old iPhone here. I'll put it there. It's good to be here. I do apologize to those who are French speaking that I'm not simultaneously translating myself into French. I did do French as one of my subjects at university. And I well remember the day I did my French oral examination. And at the end of it, my tutor said to me, you actually speak French quite well. You converse well. A French person would have no difficulty understanding you. And then he added, but unfortunately, you speak French a bit like a Dalek. So at that point, I gave up French and concentrated on English, which in itself was tough enough for a Scotsman. It's great to wake up on a Sunday morning and think to yourself, today I get to preach again. It's what I was made for. When I was a little kid, I used to embarrass my parents on a Monday morning if we took the bus into Glasgow. We didn't have a car in those days. If we took the bus into Glasgow, as a little five-year-old kid, unless they managed to stop me before I did it, I would stand on a seat and preach the sermon that I'd heard on the previous Sunday. If it happened now, social services would take me in, wouldn't they? But it's the one thing I've always wanted to do. And I love to preach the great theological profundities of Paul's letters. I love to take the Old Testament stories and look at what they have to teach us and how they point forward to the revelation of the New Testament. I love even sometimes with some trepidation to take Revelation and try to unpack some of the truths there. But most of all, the older I get, the more I want to talk about Jesus. And I've got this thing that I think we neglect the gospel stories. I may have said this to you before, but when we teach kids in Sunday school, what do we teach them? We teach them the stories of Jesus. As we get older, we tend to move on to other bits of Scripture. And I think we sometimes neglect the gospel stories. I do a bit of consultancy work with churches, and one of the things I ask pastors of churches is, if I came to your church on a Sunday morning as a new person, new to the faith, how long would I have to attend before somebody actually told me the story of Jesus? I think that's an interesting question to which I have had some interesting answers. But I want to take just one story of Jesus this morning. It's from Mark chapter 4, and I'm going to read from verse 35. Oh, by the way, I didn't mean to explain why Margaret is not with me. The rumors that she's left me are untrue. Margaret's got a real sense of calling to our neighborhood, and she regularly prayer walks the neighborhood and stops and talks to people. And a couple of times a year, she does it on a Sunday morning. Sadly, most of our neighbors are not in church on a Sunday morning. So that's when most of them are at home. So she will spend a couple of hours on a Sunday morning just walking around the neighborhood, praying for people, engage them in conversation. And we don't do it too often because normally she's in church on a Sunday morning, but that's where she is this morning. Mark chapter 4, verse 35. That day when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. And a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. But Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. And the disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. And he said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? You still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." You know, sometimes when people tell you a story that they're very excited about, but you're quite unimpressed at the end of the story. And sometimes they will add, well, you had to be there. What fascinates me about the gospel stories is that they are so vivid that you feel as if you were there, which is exactly what the gospel writers meant you to feel. I mean, this simple short story that we've read together has got a kind of eyewitness feel. It's full of details that you couldn't make up. Tells us exactly when it happened, in the evening of the day. It tells us who were there, and it even tells us that when Jesus got into this boat, other boats were with him. It's just a little detail. Tells us exactly where Jesus was when the storm blew up. He's in the stern of the boat. And it tells us exactly what he's doing. He is fast asleep on a cushion. And for me, most interesting of all, is that it tells us exactly what people said. In most stories I find, especially of the true stories, the really interesting bits are not just what happened, but who said what. And it's the people's words here that really stick in my mind. And there are three questions in this story, three questions that really stand out for me. I take them one by one. The first question seems to me to be a question of despair. Because in the middle of this storm, and Jesus is fast asleep, and the disciples are fearful for their life, their question is, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" The way they address Jesus, teacher, rabbi, is in itself significant. If you read chapter 4, we picked it up at verse 35, but if you were to read that chapter from the beginning, you will notice that it has been devoted to the teaching of Jesus. The story of the sower, the lamp on a stand, the seed that grows, the mustard seed, it's full of Jesus' teaching. It's all about his parables and his precepts. And verse 33 and 34, which occurred just before the verse we picked up the chapter, sums it up. Mark says, with many similar parables, not just these ones, but with many similar parables, Jesus spoke the word to them as much as they could understand. He did not say anything to them without using a parable, but when he was alone with his own disciples, he explained everything. Must have been fascinating. I've listened to some great teachers in my life. I try with the little modicum of gifting and talent that I have, I try to be something of a teacher. But to have sat in the evening and listened to the teaching of Jesus himself. You must be really old when you've got the Beach Boys as your ringtone. There are some people here who are older than I feel. Where was I? Yeah, to have sat in the evening and listened to Jesus, who had taught throughout the day, then take his own teaching apart and explain it. Must have been fascinating. Teacher, they call him. They have been listening to his parables and absorbing his precepts. But this is a story at the end of all that, a story not just about his parables and his precepts. You all right? Yes. How did you choose the Beach Boys? Now you just told everybody how old I am and out of touch with what's happening in the world. There are other churches you could attend, you know. You don't have to come here and insult the preacher. No, they've been listening to his parables and his precepts, but this is a story about his presence and his power. And it's a story that is recorded because of an unexpected crisis. They're on this boat, they're crossing the Lake of Galilee, and a furious squall comes up. It can happen on Lake Galilee. It's set in a basin surrounded by mountains, and sometimes colder air from the Mediterranean Sea is drawn down through the mountain passes. And when it hits the hot, humid air over Lake Galilee, it can result in a sudden storm. But it must have been a bad one, because these disciples were fishermen. They were used to the lake. They would have known it like the back of their hand. But they weren't prepared for this one. Isn't that like life? You know, we toughen up as we get older. We know that life gives you some knocks. And most of them, we cope with. And then something blows up that you didn't expect. You lose your job. A relationship ends. Somebody you love dies. Marriage problems. Kids get into trouble. Something goes badly wrong at church. It's tough when things go wrong. And here's the irony for me. When life goes wrong and the storms blow up, I think it can be in some ways even harder for a believer than an atheist. I mean, let me explain. If you're an atheist, you don't believe there's any God, and you don't believe that life ultimately has any particular meaning, then when things go wrong, you say, well, that's it. Life is pointless, meaningless. But for the believer, when storms blow up, it can be harder. You know, when an atheist says to me, how can you believe in a God of love? And you hear about something like the tsunami that killed tens of thousands a few years ago. And I have to say, yeah, that is a tough one. And it's even tougher for me because I do believe in a God of love. And I can give you some glib scientific explanation. Not that I'm a scientist, but I've heard from other people. But I really can't explain easily why in a world made by a God of love, things like that happen. Sometimes it can be tough if you're a believer. And you actually wonder, does God care? Is there a God? It was all the worse because Jesus was there, the great teacher, and he's asleep for goodness sake. They thought he was different. Why doesn't God do something? I read an awful story in the Guardian this week. A young woman in Morocco. It's not a nice story. It broke my heart. Young woman in Morocco was taken captive by 8 young guys who took it in turn to rape her. They were later arrested. But then for some crazy reason, I don't know what the legal system is in Morocco, but they were let out on bail. And they started to send her text messages saying, we recorded all that on our phones. And if you press this case, we're going to put it on the internet. She committed suicide by setting herself alight. I don't know that young lady at all. But how desperate must it have been? That feeling of nobody cares. I am utterly alone. Most of us, thank God, haven't gone through stuff like that. But most of us have gone through moments when we've thought, does he care? Does he care? You know those times when you come to church and we're singing the glorious worship songs and you stood there thinking, I'm hanging on by the skin of my teeth to believe any of this. It happens. It's a question of despair. Teacher, don't you care that we're about to drown? Let me take you a little further in the story. Because what happens next is wonderful. He got up This is how Mark tells the story. He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Be quiet, be still." And then the wind died down and it was completely calm. And he said to his disciples, "There's a question about doubt. Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Now, before we think about Jesus' question, think about his action. When we were little kids, and it rained and we wanted to play, and we couldn't get out of doors, we used to have a little rhyme that we used to say, "Rain, rain, go away, come again another day." But we were kids. Intelligent adults don't talk to the weather. I mean, some intelligent adults on the BBC every evening think they can predict the weather. It seems to me they haven't got it right yet. But intelligent adults don't go out and talk to the weather. We all know the story of King Canute, whose foolish courtiers were praising him, said he could even stop the tide coming in. And he showed them that he couldn't. You know what? You go out there, whether it's sunny or raining, and make a practice of it regularly, of addressing the weather. You probably won't be here next time I come. If they invite me again, you'll be locked up. What on earth is Jesus doing? I mean, we read these stories and we take it for granted. He stood on a boat that's going like this and he talks to the weather, for goodness sake. He says to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And it was completely calm. Why did Jesus do that? Well, he did it for the sake of the disciples who thought they were going to drown. But there's an even deeper reason. How does John talk about Jesus at the beginning of his gospel? "The Word of God became a human being." The Word that speaks everything into existence. The Genesis story tells us that the Word of God spoke the earth and the sea and everything in it into existence. He is Lord of the sea, excuse me, and Lord of the storm. Psalm 89. "O Lord God, who is like you? You are mighty, O Lord, and your faithfulness surrounds you. You rule over the surging sea. When its waves mount up, you still them." That's a poem, a prayer, addressed by an ancient Hebrew poet to the one God in heaven. And why does Jesus say, "Quiet, be still"? So they'll know who he is. This man is God amongst them. Actually, what he says, if you translated it literally, is, "Quiet, be muzzled." It's the same words that he uses to the man who is possessed by an evil spirit in Mark chapter 1, verse 25. "Quiet, be muzzled." He is Lord over every force in the universe. And even when he seems to be asleep, he is in control. Even when he seems to be asleep, he's in control. That's his action. Now you understand his question. Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? You've heard my teaching and my parables. You know something of my presence and power. So why do you doubt me now? Now let me say, there's doubt and there's doubt. Let me explain. There's doubt that I respect that comes from not being able to figure it out. The doubt that struggles with some aspects of belief for the Christian faith, and it's part of our humanity, and we should not make people feel guilty about that. Our neighbours were away for a month or so, and we looked after their house, popped in and made sure the mail was picked up, all that kind of stuff. We do it quite regularly when they go away, and they said, "We want to say thanks, can we take you out for a meal?" Well, What a question to ask a Scotsman. So they took us out for a meal. Now John, I've changed his name to protect. He doesn't believe. He says, I can't believe that heaven stuff. He's a thoroughly decent man. He's also very good at DIY, which I'm not, and came in this week to put up a shelf that I couldn't put up. And we talked a little bit about heaven. And he struck, what do I do with somebody like that? Do I tell him, what an evil man you are for not believing? Or do I keep talking and keep praying? And respect that sometimes, it's a struggle for me to believe sometimes. And I see nothing in the Gospels that condemns that kind of honest doubt that struggles to figure things out and believe. Mark chapter 9 verse 24, a father asked Jesus to heal his son and says, if you can do anything, and Jesus replies, if I can, everything is possible to him who believes. And I love the honesty of the father. He says, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. I'm struggling to believe that. And I love the story of Thomas, who was missing on that first Sunday and said, I can't believe. People don't rise from the dead. I'll only believe if I can touch the nail print in his hand and see the wound in his side. And nowhere is Thomas condemned. A week later, Jesus says, when Thomas says, there you are. So I think there's doubt and there's doubt. There's doubt that's part of a genuine struggle. And we all go through it. And some people have great difficulties with it. And we've got to pray and love them. And that's where living the Christian life comes into play. Because you want to show them a life that they cannot explain. It's an interesting thing about John, our neighbour. His father-in-law, who's now in his late 90s, is a devout and good Christian man. And Margaret said to him, he really is a good man, your father-in-law. And John said, yeah, he is, and it's difficult for me to say, but I think it's got something to do with his faith. But then there's doubt. That's really fear. There is panic on board this little ship. It's very different from the doubt of the man who struggled to figure out just how Jesus would manage to heal his son. This is the doubt that fears that Jesus doesn't care. This is the doubt that forgets everything he's done in the past. And this is the doubt that focuses on the problem and forgets the power of God. This is the doubt that ignores all God's goodness and thinks that in the end, evil will probably win. The story of Jesus stilling the storm was preserved and passed on by the gospel writers, I think, for three reasons. Number one, it really happened. That's why you've got that eyewitness feel to it. They didn't make it up. It really happened. Number two, it must have left an indelible impression on the minds of everyone who was there. You wouldn't forget a moment like that. Can you imagine them telling it around the fire and saying, one minute he was fast asleep, we're panicking, the next minute he's up and he's talking to the waves and wow. And there's a third reason. The gospel writers recorded this and the other stories they did record, not just so that we would say, wow, but because it's full of lessons that we need to learn. Even when we're not on board a ship, being tossed about by waves. And here's the lesson, I think. All sorts of storms may rage around us. It may seem at times as if we are being utterly overwhelmed. It may seem at moments that God is either asleep or absent or doesn't care or doesn't exist. But he will never, ever forsake us. He is Lord of every situation. How do we know that's true? How do we know that that's not just wishful thinking? We know it's true because of stories like this. We know it's true because of experiences in life. And we know it's true, as we were reminded earlier, because of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. I don't know exactly what happened in first century Christian meetings. I do know they didn't read the Bible, because there wasn't one. There was the Old Testament scriptures, but you didn't have Matthew, Mark, Luke. You know what I'm pretty sure they would do is, they would tell stories about Jesus. And they would share the meal. And in those earliest days, the breaking of bread and communion was part of that agape fellowship meal. As they would share fellowship, eat together, and celebrate the Lord's death until his return. And they would do it with that odd dynamic that makes Christian worship different from any other gathering. They would look back and tell stories about Jesus. Christian worship always involves looking back to Jesus in the days of his flesh. But it would be focused in the present, because they would say, he is really alive and really here. And it also looks to the future, because he's coming again. And the stories have a vibrancy and a power that no other story could have. So far we've had two questions. We've had a question of doubt. Don't you care that we perish? We've had the question of despair. Don't you care that we perish? We've had Jesus' question relating to doubt. Oh, it's a little faith. Why don't you believe? And then there is that glorious question that changes everything. I've called it the question of discovery. Verse 41. He stilled the wind, and they were terrified. And they asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and waves obey him. That's the question that anybody who has any kind of encounter with Jesus has eventually to ask. Who is this? See, there are two things about Jesus that you have to hold together always. And they are both right here in this story. They're right there whenever you face up to the life and teaching of Jesus. The first is this. There's the truth of his humanity. He shares humanity and frailty with his brothers and sisters. That's us. And where is he at the beginning of this story? He's asleep. He's exhausted. He is, in fact, so utterly bone weary that he sleeps through a storm that's fierce enough to scare experienced fishermen out of their wits. He's been speaking all day. No PA system. We're mollycoddled now. Our grandparents would think, what the heck do you need a microphone for in a room that size? He's exhausted. He's been speaking all day, no PA system, and it really takes it out of you. He is just like us in all sorts of ways. He gets tired. You read the gospel record. He gets tired, he gets hungry and thirsty, he gets angry and annoyed, he gets disappointed, he laughs, he cries, he's compassionate, he gets ticked off with self-righteous religious types who are more concerned about the rules than they are about people. He likes little kids, he's great at parties, he's lousy at funerals, he ruined every funeral he ever attended, including his own, but he loves parties, he gets hurt, he bleeds, he dies. He is one of us. There arose a heresy early in the Christian church that Jesus was not really human. That he just appeared to be human, but he wasn't really human. And there's another heresy that's quite close to it, that actually he had a human body, but in his head and his mind, it was God's head and mind. That's not humanity. That's God dressed up as a human being. The gospel records are insistent that Jesus was completely human. He is sometimes amazed by people whose lack of faith. I remember an old lady in one of our churches saying to me, Jesus knew everything. He knew all about aeroplanes and spaceships. I'm thinking, don't be so daft, woman. Of course, if he knew that, he wasn't really human. No, he had a deep, deep discernment. But to move from that to saying, Jesus, listen, this man is as human as we are. He sweats, he does it all. He would, dare I say, have to visit the bathroom like we do. He's human. He's human, like all of us want to be in our best moments. In fact, he is the only truly, fully human person who ever lived. Is it? Oh, goodness me, I should have shut up minutes ago, shouldn't I? I'll be finished in a minute. When you talk about Jesus, it gets exciting, doesn't it? I like talking about Scotland. I like talking about Manchester United. I like talking about Jesus better. You want to know what it means to be truly alive and truly human? Look at Jesus. But here's the other thing. I said there were two things when you ask, who is this man? It's his divinity. He shares his humanity with us. He shares his divinity and authority with his Father. He claimed to be able to do what any self-respecting Jew of his time knew only God could do. He could still storms. He could make people whole. And the thing that really gobsmacked him was he could forgive people's sins. Not just the sins they'd done against him, but all the wrong things they'd done. You probably know C.S. Lewis's great words about Jesus. He said, I want to prevent anyone saying that really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That, says C.S. Lewis, is one of the things we mustn't say. A man who says the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with a man who thinks he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else he is a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us. He did not intend to. That's why we meet Sunday by Sunday, when we could be sat at home drinking coffee and reading the newspaper. Because we want to celebrate together who he is. Not just a great moral teacher, not just a figure from history, but the risen, crucified, risen, living, coming again Son of God. And in every storm of life, he's with us. Praise be to God. I'm sorry, I've taken a bit longer than I should have done.